Since the beginning of time, even unto these ancient stones, that evil, supernatural creatures exist in a world of darkness. And it is also said, man using the magic power of the ancient runic symbols can call forth these powers of darkness, the demons of hell. Through the ages, men have feared and worshipped these creatures. The practice of witchcraft, the cults of evil have endured and exist to this day.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
I'm here.
Wrong episode.
Yeah, you missed one episode. And
I'm all kerfuffled.
Kerfuffled. And Trish Coughlin.
Hey, everybody.
Was it at least a little bit creepy?
No.
Just yeah. Dumb. Thanks.
I don't know.
You got to try harder, man.
Yeah, I was scared, but just that I thought you might have watched the wrong movie.
Well, that was at risk. When I told everybody what we're doing this week, I'm like, Night of the Demon, no S, singular, not plural, singular.
And from the 50s.
Yes, 57, and you guys at home might be going, we don't know that one. Well, there's a reason why we're doing this one, because you should. It is one of the more classic horror movies from the 50s that hasn't actually got a remake yet.
And it's kind incredibly of high rated.
Begs for it. Yeah, it's got a good rating. I really enjoyed watching it.
Yes.
It was the first for me. Yeah. I mean, it's got its problems, especially when you're watching it with a modern sensibility. But
the story itself is quite engaging.
There's a lot of bits in there that really are timeless.
There's actually one bit in there that actually kind of creeped me out just a little bit. And then I love the ending. I think the ending needs a little work, but I love the ending.
So, some of the cheap jump scares were like, oh, come on. I don't like that when movies do it now. And yeah. I didn't like it in the – I'm sure it worked a lot better in the 50s, but
– Well, yeah. Some of those cheap jump scares weren't supposed to be there.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The demon itself wasn't supposed to be in the movie because that was all done against the director's wishes. He wanted it all be cerebral and suggested. I think he did a decent job for the most part, but if anything, I don't think he did enough of it. But
that was strangely enough, the director has a really good point. The whole point of the movie is the guy's not believing in it, but to like hint at it. Gives more tension than to just outright show it. Oh yeah, no, there is a demon. He just doesn't believe it. No. Have him not believe it. Have the other guy believe it, and then you don't know who to believe.
Yeah. Oh, I love that this movie has that psychological impact and misdirection, and it should be there constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, if anything, they didn't do it enough.
I think that the fact they had that demon pop up right near the beginning of the movie kind of took away from that. And I think that was part of the issue the director had with it is like, well, if you put that demon in, you're undermining everything else that I'm doing.
Yes.
Right.
And it did.
Yeah. Yeah. They originally already said what he wanted to do, but the studio, of course, it's the 50s. I want monsters. And they actually wanted Ray Harryhausen to do the designs and make that special effect. Unfortunately, he was busy with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Made a good choice.
Yes. A tough choice, but a good choice.
Tough choice. And for what little we see of the creature, I think it's handled fairly well. It looks pretty good coming out of the dark. It's wispy and smoky.
At the end, yes, he looks great. The first time I saw him, I'm like, oh, geez.
Oh, well, I mean, it's 50s.
It's 50s.
It looks as good as it's going to get in the 50s. Yeah. It barely moves.
Yeah, it's like a... I don't know. To me, it was like a repurposed Godzilla for part of it.
Sure. Yeah, no, it was probably a guy in a suit who couldn't even move.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was... But the very kind of end part where you kind of see the face of the creature. I was telling Sam this earlier. It reminded me of the wolf in Neverending Story.
Yeah. Although I don't think it undermined the film, because when I saw it the first time, I'm like, well... Is it a demon, or is that just something he's seeing in his brain? Because he was already panicked earlier in the movie. So, when we don't know why.
It would
so,
be...
part of me was like, okay, well, I'm interested to see where this goes. Is it a demon, or is this just in his brain and he's thinking he's seeing a demon?
See, what would have made it better, I think, if you're actually going to put in a demon at the beginning, is don't have him... like mauled like he's supposed to be, have it look like he simply died in the accident he had.
That would have made, that would have fed into you to what you're going with that, and I could see that working really well.
But they just again undermined it by
doing no, they should
silly thing.
They every you know, when somebody's looking at the crime scene or whatever or the accident scene, everything should relate to the car crash.
Yes.
As far as the damage goes, and maybe something unexplained, or maybe there's a shard of metal and it looks like claws. That's...
Yeah.
So you can always question what you're seeing.
Yeah, like if he's cut up, it'll look like possibly the glass from the car.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah. But it's... Yeah, they make it too... They put too much effort into making it be like, no, yes, there really is a demon.
Yeah, and I think that kind of informs in what we are going to do with this movie.
Yeah, I think we've already started. We're already starting to head in a direction, aren't we, folks?
We're starting to start it off, yes. Okay, this movie was based on a story called Casting the Runes. What a great title. Mm-hmm. And later adaptations of this story for television and radio, some of them did use that title. And that was by M.R. James. And the screenplay was by Charles Bennett and Hal E. Chester. Charles Bennett went on to do The Man Who Knew Too Much, another great movie that actually has got... It's an older movie that got remade as still an old movie. So I think it was 30s and then the 50s. So we might cover that. We've been talking about doing some old remakes because this is not a new phenomenon, folks.
No.
And Hal E. Chester went on to do School of Scoundrels, also been remade, and Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And then there was an uncredited, I guess he was probably a script doctor of some sort, it was Cy Enfield, and he went on to some great movies like Hell Drivers and Zulu.
Hmm.
Yeah. This was directed by Jacques Tourneur. Tourneur? Turner?
Tourneur?
The French version of Turner. Yeah, sure. And he directed another great horror film called Cat People, which has been remade as well. So we will probably be revisiting him again. And, of course, this was Night of the Demons from 1957, but in the U.S. it was released as Curse of the Demon. They had shed a few scenes, but later DVD and VHS releases brought the some of the UK footage back into the cuts. So
yeah, they
I watched
like
the
4 minutes out. So.
Yeah, it was somewhere around 83 minutes or something like that, and back up to 95. So it was actually fairly significant. It was probably about 70 minutes.
Yeah.
A really short movie.
Yeah.
you cut out too much.
Well, I mean, that was long for the late 50s, though. I mean, right? I mean, that was a long to average.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, generally speaking, horror movies now run about an hour and a half if you're lucky.
Yeah, or unlucky, depending on what you're watching.
Yeah, sometimes they're over 2 hours, but...
An hour and a half is good. I feel that's a nice slice, because you know you're not watching an hour-long TV show.
Trying to hold that tension past 90 minutes in any kind of horror movie is difficult. You got to be exceptional to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, but you have to be, like, just an expert at mood and, like, building everything and having good characters, because here's the thing. You can have a long movie, but if you're not on the journey with these people, not going to work out.
Yeah, and trust us, we know... We are about at the halfway point on the recording of our 31 Days of Horror. If you haven't joined us, I mean, we're getting near the end when this airs, but hopefully you've been following us on our social media. And if you haven't, we have the roundup will be coming up in a few weeks in November with all the movies we had watched for 31 Days of Horror. And hopefully you are... following us, or we'll enjoy that episode. We certainly are having fun watching the movies that we're covering.
Oh, possibly a few other lists. We know we have some other people out there who are attempting the 31 Days of Horror.
That's right. Yes. So if you're hearing this episode and you've been following along and doing your own 31 Days of Horror challenge, send us your lists. we'd like to see the final product. So send us your list as soon as you've hit that 31, magic 31, when you've finished your marathon, and submit it to us via our email, invasionoftheremake@gmail.com. And we will read this as many of those lists on the air as possible and put little stars by the ones you liked the most and, I don't know, X's by the ones you didn't.
Yeah.
You can put a little description of, like, why you hated it or why you liked it.
But yeah.
We won't be able to cover too much detail, but we'll do as much as we can within that episode because it's going to be a long one anyway.
They usually are, yes.
Well, then the number of movies we have to cover.
And if I have to split it up, we'll split it up. That's fine. We might make two episodes out of it, but it'll be as long as it needs to be because it's fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but we won't be talking about this one that much because
yes,
I think all of us have this on our list for 31 Days of Horror.
Yeah, yes. None of us had seen this movie before, so it is included on the list, but we're going to cover it all here right now. Yeah. And then when we hit it on the list, we were like, go see this episode.
Yeah, we'll just reference it back.
Yeah, we'll reference it back because, you know, we won't need to talk about it because we're going to talk about it right now. This movie starred Dana Andrews as John Holden, and he really liked working with the director, and he went on to work with him again on his next picture. Peggy Cummins was Joanna Harrington. Niall McGuinness was Dr. Carswell, also a really cool Bond villain that never was.
I know, right?
I the first second, I'm like, he's a fucking Bond villain.
Well, I got confused because it's like Carswell, and I kept thinking Criswell from Plan 9.
Oh, I think with all of those magicians and stuff and fortune tellers that were prevalent at that time, that was just one of those magic names, right?
Yeah.
Maurice Denham was Professor Harrington, who we just said dies earlier in the beginning of the movie.
Who I didn't even cast.
I didn't cast him.
I did cast him. Sorry, yeah.
Liam Redmond, Peter Elliott, Janet Barrow, Brian Wilde, and Reginald Beckwith. Athene Sailor. So, yes, that kind of rounds out the cast. And like a lot of these older movies, they kind of keep their cast small and tight, and they still manage to create a pretty cool movie. And your lead character, John Holden, is heading to the UK to consult on this demon cult case that is being, I think, is it Interpol that's investigating them? But he's actually being brought in by Professor Harrington for consultation, who's actually a cult member.
Yeah.
And he's the person who also dies at the beginning because he's freaked out about what's happening within the cult, but we don't get to hear about what that is until a little bit later.
Yeah,
he's coming to I thought he was going to speak at some sort of paranormal conference where they focus on debunking these supernatural.
Yeah, and that's essentially what he is. He's a debunker. He's looks at ghost cases or whatever, and I do like that aspect because fairly early in the movie when him and Joanna get together, it really feels like a reverse X-Files moment. One's the skeptic and one's the believer, except it's, you know, it's the role reverse.
Yeah,
which I think is interesting. It was a little clumsily done where they bring in Joanna. They're both on the trip to the UK to meet the same person, not knowing that they're both heading to meet the now deceased Professor Harrington.
Well,
she's Professor Harrington's niece.
She's coming home. He's coming to visit. So, but I had to say the whole bit on the plane.
I loved it.
I really loved it.
It was fun. I actually laughed out loud when she makes him get up and she goes, "I'm sorry," and he goes, "Good."
He is so grumpy through this whole movie.
He's a miserable, miserable man.
But I have the same problem. Like I cannot sleep on a plane. Like I'm watching her do this. I'm like, Joanna, I totally get it.
Yeah, I get it too. I can't sleep on planes.
But I want to find out what the layout of this plane is because she goes to see the one stewardess and it looks like she's in an office.
Yes, I wondered about that too. I'm like, really? I don't know that I've ever seen a plane with like...
It didn't look that big on the outside.
No.
Is she on Air Force One?
No. And then the seats went back and then slid kind of forward like a little chaise lounge. I want to be on this plane, guys.
It did look pretty comfy, but I'm like, why is there an office in there?
Yes. I know.
Yeah, I mean, she's got like a little desk and everything.
Yeah.
Yes. If you've ever
and wood paneling.
Yes. If you've ever been on a plane, like the galley is teeny tiny. Like the bathrooms, you can barely get in if you're a normal sized person.
They probably shot it afterwards, realizing she got up and went nowhere.
Did she just
go to the washroom?
But you know how you do that? You shoot that scene, but have like the stewardess sitting in like a closet. Just make it small.
Right.
Yes. Make it look like it really is on a plane.
Yeah. If you need a desk, then you grab one of those like little school desks.
Yes. Have something that like flips down, like would be on a plane.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't even have the trays didn't even fold back on the back of those seats, right? Like she had a little portable tray that she was walking around with.
Yeah.
Which might be how they used to be.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with planes.
I'll defer to that.
Yeah, I have no idea what planes were like in the 1950s, but apparently they had fully furnished wood panel desks.
They built the plane around it.
Yes.
Well, you never know when you're going to have to do some really heavy duty work on a plane.
Or maybe it was an IKEA kit, you know.
It's an IKEA plane.
No, I am so not flying on that.
Really, we have all these extra pieces. It'll be fine.
Everything's rattling around. Anybody got that funky key? No? Oh, shit. Oh,
no.
We can't fix this. Yeah, everybody, like, if the floor falls out, tuck your feet up.
Just a terrible, terrible thought. Look out, Boeing.
The IKEA plane.
Good God. Okay, I'm going to run the trailer for Night of the Demon, and we'll really start cracking into this.
It has been written since the beginning of time that evil, supernatural creatures exist in a world of darkness. And it is also said, man can call forth these powers of darkness, the demons of hell.
It is the night of the demon.
And tonight is the night that Dana Andrews, as a daring scientist, defies the mysterious, murderous devil cult in a desperate battle against the demons of hell.
Oh, why did you drop the poker?
Red hot.
Didn't you know? Oh, my boy, you're as pale as death.
There was something in here.
He has been chosen.
I've been chosen for what? What do you mean?
Today I found all the pages of my desk calendar torn out after October the 22nd. I know why. He died on the 22nd. John, what's the matter?
The same thing happened to my desk calendar after the 28th.
The frightened girl. The master of witchcraft.
You will die, as I said, at 10 o'clock on the 28th of this month. Your time allowed is just 3 days from now.
Skeptical? Don't make up your mind till you see this masterpiece of macabre magic. Because, after all, evil supernatural creatures really do exist.
Very cool.
Yes.
Love those old trailers. Always say that, but I do.
Because they were fun, right? I mean, they were designed to get you really, really intrigued. By telling you and teasing you instead of giving you, like, all the best scenes in the movie, they do now.
Yeah, you can usually tell when they start telling the main story within the trailer. I'm like, all right, don't need to see that one.
Yeah.
See, and I like the symphonic music in the background of most of these trailers. Like, it's not just one big wong, wong, boom. Like, just they've got somebody who's actually conducting a symphony to make that music.
Yeah.
And I mean, and even in the movie itself, the music that they use in these 50s movies really is part of creating the atmosphere for the movie. Movies nowadays, some do it. I mean, It Follows is a great example of where the music is part of the movie. Like, it actually helps lead the story, right? And this one does that as well. There are moments there where the music informs you as to how you should feel, right? Without giving too much away.
And it's even more important in the 50s where the technology is not there. So, I mean, the movie's black and white. You don't have color, so a lot of color palette to influence mood is black and white. So Yeah, there's other ways to get around it. They had to be more clever, and music's a big part of setting that tone.
Yeah, and this movie was very effective in it. Yeah.
True. Well, a fun experiment if you want to do and find out exactly how this works is watch a movie on mute. Watch it on mute and then see how scared you are of any given situation. You can find yourself being like, oh, this is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because it'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with those movies with a lot of cheap jump scares, because a large part of it isn't the jumping out, it's the big bang or noise that comes with it. They're not scares, they're startles.
Yep.
Right? And I have a huge issue with them, and I know you don't particularly care for them either.
Yeah. No.
Because now they're not effective.
Now I just kind of roll my eyes and... Yeah. Sometimes they'll get me.
The noise still startles me. I'm sensitive to those noises. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Even though I know that the jump's coming.
I'm sure most people that have those jump scares, they're embarrassed by it more than scared. They're like, God damn
it. Yeah. There's been a few times I've been like, ah, oh, crap.
You're like, I fucking knew it was coming, and I still jumped.
Or I've made too loud of a noise, and now I'm embarrassed in the theater.
I need to see more movies with you.
Apparently, yeah.
I'm more entertained when other people get scared at movie theaters and stuff. Usually that's what's entertaining me more than the movie itself.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The Conjuring 2. I was like, ah! Like this noise I have never made in my entire damn life came out. that was the worst part.
Oh, that's insane.
Yeah.
But it's like the music gets right. It tells you to be prepared. That jump scare is coming.
Now, I mentioned that Niall McGuinness looks like a Bond villain. Yeah. And I think Dana Andrews kind of looks like a mid-50s Sean Connery as well, depending on what angle you're looking at.
Yeah, and I was going to mention that too, because when you mentioned that he looked like the Bond villain, I'm like, well, yeah, we have Bond's doppelganger, Sean Connery's doppelganger, in this movie. There's a few shots where the light's just right, and you're like, wait a minute, is that the same actor? Is that... No, that's Sean Connery.
And even though he's American, there's a certain... the way he delivers lines that
and resonates
really
to the voice, it's very similar.
Yeah, it feels very similar.
And the beard.
Huh?
The
villain. You're talking about the villain.
The villain.
I'm talking
beard.
About Dana Andrews.
Oh, no, Dana Andrews. No,
yeah.
No.
No, oh, yeah, the other guy. He's the stereotypical.
Do you expect me to believe in a demon? No, Mr. No, Bond. I expect you to die by the demon. That would make, like, his evil toady that he has, his mom.
I liked his mom.
I loved his mom.
The bad guy's mom is in this. She's very nice. And so is he, for the most part. He is, despite having been outed in the papers, being this head of this demon cult,
he's a pretty nice guy.
He's a pretty nice dude. You know, he's very passive-aggressive. He kind of warns off the investigation. And he's very polite. He's like, well, lend you all the research you want.
Which he then doesn't.
Which he doesn't. Well, because he goes, well, I have it. You won't be able to read it, but I have it.
But that's not the point. You already offered to give it to him. So screw that noise.
No, he's certainly passive aggressive about it.
Yeah. No, he's an outright liar. He offered it and didn't do it.
But it made him very entertaining. And it was funny because you had these mixed feelings about him. It's like you kind of like him, but you really don't.
Oh, well, yeah. When John Holden breaks into his house at one point to get what he's looking for, which he never does get. Oh, no, actually he does. It's in the notebook. He does figure out certain things during that time. But, you know, he's attacked by a minor demon, which was the cat that turns into a leopard. And then
I thought it was a jaguar.
Yeah, it was a jaguar.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
A large spotted cat.
Jaguar, leopard, whatever.
And you could really up that whole scene rather than him flailing around with the stuffed...
Oh, sure, animal. Yeah. And he picks up the poker for the fire, and it's hot. And then the lights come on, and in comes Carswell.
Yeah.
And he dropped the poker, and he picks it right up. Oh, the poker's hot. Oh, it's cold. It's fine.
Yeah.
And he treats him like...
And his mom.
He doesn't even accuse him for breaking in the house, and they're very friendly to each other.
Yeah, there's actually a line there where he says, where he gives the cat heck for attacking him. He says, we don't attack him. We were just protecting him.
You were protecting the room, not attacking people.
Yeah. I left the book out for him, is what he says. He says, I left the book out for him. Yeah. And I love that. That was a great little, like, interaction between the two of them is like, this guy's always a step ahead of Holden's character.
Yeah. And to me, that's like another level of sort of evil. Like, you do like him, but the level of that is sort of the charisma and the fact he's just really playing with him at this point. Mm-hmm. So yes. He's even more evil at that point.
Yeah, you really don't know how to feel about him as a villain. I mean, he's throwing kids' Halloween parties and dressing up as a clown,
which I think a hobo clown, which I think we could really mine for some really interesting stuff, considering the cult angle, right?
Dr. Bobo,
yeah,
Dr.
And
Bobo.
That's one thing I would certainly amp up in the remake is the whole cult thing, because it didn't feel all that cultist except for that Halloween.
Well,
party.
We have a good
idea.
I
want to know where the children came from.
We have a good idea. Well, he said they're children of the villagers that are around his place.
Then that's the cult.
But and they make mention that he's got a very and they're very aware of the demon, because when he does visit some of the villagers, the parents of the guy they caught, who I'm never sure what his crime is.
He killed somebody, but.
No, he's blamed for the death of his brother. What happened was his brother passed the parchment to him to kill him before he could get killed by the demon. He passed it back to his brother. His brother died. He got framed for his brother's murder.
Ah,
yeah, and that's the hook in this movie, is this parchment that summons the demon, and the demon targets whoever's holding the parchment, and the parchment has to be willingly taken, and it's usually handed over through trickery, and this also happens to Holden. At the beginning of the movie, when he's at the museum doing some research, and Carswell comes to visit after already trying to warn him off with a phone call, introduces himself accidentally on purpose, drops the files on the floor, and picks them up and manages to slip the parchment in. This is where I think that they didn't do enough of some of the psychological stuff, because every once in a blue moon, you'd see his Holden's vision go fuzzy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes him about halfway through the movie before he even realizes he has it. Even I thought, I'm like, I didn't think it was a parchment. I thought it was, he's like, oh, I don't take anything from anybody. I'm like, you took his business card. And then there was the disappearing ink. I don't even remember what it said, but.
Time allowed is 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. So it even tells him what the timeline is.
Uh-huh.
So Carswell's got a date in mind, knows when it's coming. And hasn't tipped off where it is. And he's constantly trying to kind of warn him off and say, you know, hand the files back or something.
And this is where you can amp up like the psychological bit where like, is he just getting drugged every once in a while by somebody?
Well, he's a fairly heavy drinker.
Yes. But I mean,
he's drinking and smoking in almost every scene.
That's the 50s too, right?
Yeah. 50s too. But so, I mean, you could have that whole thing where that is a bit of a mystery. You don't know if he's getting dosed on a basis just to make people, and who knows, maybe this guy is somewhat of a charlatan that managed to stumble upon a real spell and he might have been dosing his followers. Who the hell knows?
Who knows? Yeah.
Well, and we've got a lot of it is charisma, and he's got a lot of it. And we've seen this in real life cults, Jim Jones and the Manson family, you know, so we have a much better understanding of what drives a cult now and how we can shape it for our movie.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And which just makes it that much scarier, because we're a little more familiar with what that looks like now, especially with some of the tragedies that have come out of some of these darker cults.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I was sort of, as we were talking here, something popped into my head, and maybe you guys have already made the comparison. Does this not feel a lot like The Ring? In some ways, you think about the method of delivery and the set timeline for their death and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
When I was watching this, when I was thinking about directors, Gore Verbinski was one of the directors that popped into my head, because the original Ring had that same kind of feel to me. Mm-hmm. Like that's the tension through the search to find a solution rather than the big monster, right? The monster was a factor, but not the end of the end purpose of the movie was not the monster. It was that tension created trying to save their lives.
Like the whole point is like the whole, it's an investigation.
Yeah.
That they're trying to basically pre-solve their own murder.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. And I guess that magical parchment thing goes back a long ways. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they use the more mystical runes from Ireland and Scotland and whatnot. But the Japanese had similar things on the ribbons. And they could possess people by throwing the ribbons on people's heads and all sorts of
And there's like
things.
Voodoo. There's all sorts of... There's versions of this basically culturally, globally.
Yeah. But yeah, it was one of the things I was watching, I'm like...
Yeah. In fact, for my 31 Days of Horror, I watched something else where parchment or like this cloth was a very important aspect to that movie. So
Yeah, and I got halfway through a movie before it died on me. There was one that was in this room.
You save that for another episode.
But yeah, but this is it's a fascinating concept, and that was the whole thing. Like, I love the tension where it, the crackling tension of like what's real, what's not, who's a charlatan, who's not a charlatan. Because yeah. I mean, you can have aspects of his character be where he does use trickery to fool his followers.
Yeah.
How much of it is real?
Well, that's just it. How much of it is real? And I think that's the big aspect of this movie. How much? Because again, you know, he's a magician and a performer too. So there should be, like, I love the fact that there's sleight of hand in moving that parchment around.
Yeah. I would.
And
like
Holden, as somebody who's debunked, knows a few tricks of his own.
Yes.
And I would like to see the first, like, probably 20 minutes of the movie develop that more, the cult and Holden's character, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of establish him as an expert in debunking.
Yes.
And establish the how comprehensive this cult is, right? Because it's, I think that'll add a lot of tension between the two warring factions, as it were. And it'll also give you sort of more of a basis for background. You'll be more involved in both characters, mm-hmm. right? I think my one issue with the movie is I didn't really like Holden very much. I didn't care if he lived or died, to be completely honest. I thought he'd be a bit of a dick.
Yeah, the skepticism got old after a while. Like, even when things were starting to happen and he was starting to really see things, he was still so skeptical. Like, there was just, no, that's got to be something else. And
yeah, and the fact that I think we already mentioned that he's grumpy the whole way through the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm. I think there's, like, one scene where he's kind of flirting with Joanna, and that's the only time that I can recall him being at all friendly.
Well, and this is the whole thing, like, when you're talking about the skeptic, it's a good line to walk where you can be them. It, when you talk about X-Files, they did flip it in a certain way where in X-Files, Mulder was total believer but obnoxious about it. And Scully was skeptic but still really likable. Now he's a skeptic but also obnoxious. So that kind of really mm-hmm. downgrades how much you want to see of him. So if you can make him like just a joyful skeptic, he's like, no, the world, like you could have him really like magic and magic shows, but mm-hmm. not have him
not
believe
it. We're following him around a lot while Joanna's doing most of the legwork.
She's doing a lot of legwork, yeah.
Yeah.
She needs more time on screen.
Yeah, and that's just it. We need to see her doing more to convince him as well.
Yeah.
Since if she's going to be doing all that legwork, we need to see a little bit more of that and how she's kind of getting around, because he's the main focus of Carswell, not realizing she's kind of working from the background and she's not getting near the kind of attention that she probably should be.
Because she's the real foil.
Yeah.
But Holden's always in Carswell's face, whereas she's always in the background and very polite and likes his mom.
Yeah, well, his mom and her get along great. I feel there was a whole nother story going on that I was really interested in, because his mom immediately takes Joanne to go look at the book. His mom doesn't. And I also want to see that tension between her son. Like,
yeah,
Carswell's
always annoyed with her mom, but there doesn't seem to be real repercussions, even though mom seems a wee bit scared of him.
Yeah, but I want mom to be like, this has to stop. I want her to be generally more active and be like, this has to end, son. This is not right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like, she's his moral compass and he's ignoring it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. For me in this movie, like for when I'm rethinking it, I want to make the cast younger. Instead of his mom, I was thinking maybe make it a wife and we can have more conflict there.
Oh, no, I cast his mom in mind of having a really strong-willed
I cast it
mother.
As a wife.
Yeah.
I cast it as a wife.
I have a mom, but there's a reason for it. I have...
Although
my cast
is young enough that we could still make it the mom, for sure.
Yeah, I have an idea about what I want to do with it where it has to be the mom to make it more impactful. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's there's the scene that actually made me... I mean, it didn't make me uncomfortable, but it kind of creeped me out, was the scene with Mr. Meek, with the medium. That was really well done. The different voices coming out of him, and it was really well shot. That the voices were excellent. Like, I'm actually going, this is actually kind of creepy.
Yeah. Well, when I thought about it, I'm like, well, there's nothing in the movie that we couldn't just make it the wife, and she could still be the same person, still have the same connections and whatnot. She could still have Mr. Meek, but we could have that conflict within the couple itself. Yeah. And that's maybe motive why he doesn't do anything to her, but. You know, at the same time, maybe to protect his own ass, he might.
Well, and that's exactly
it. And I think he would do that to his mother, too.
There's not... I mean, if we're going to modernize it, there's not enough people at risk in the original. Not really.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I have a reason for it.
Her,
but...
You know, she's got her understandings of it too. So I actually, because the reason why I had it, because I liked a lot of the misdirection happening in this movie.
Yeah.
He lives on this huge estate. Where is this money coming from? And who's going to get it if Carswell dies? That's why I wanted to make it the wife.
I see how you're doing
it. I wanted to add some new layers to the film.
But you can also do it.
Because a lot of this is a mystery, murder mystery movie.
Yeah.
But at that time period, actually, in most time periods, if there's no real will in place, the next of kin, which would be his mother, would still get it.
If the mother's around, which in my version, she's not. So.
Yeah, but she is in mine, so she's going to get it.
I have no opinion on the matter.
Well, no, that's why we all come from a very different angle. So I'm just presenting mine.
Yeah,
so.
I see where you're going because it does create another layer.
I think that's a part of the movie I think I really want to keep intact is a lot of the murder mystery and some of the misdirection, and I want to add more to that because, you know, we're modern society now. We could add a few more layers to this and really make this interesting and have lots of twists and turns, and it's never the person you think it is. And
I mean,
what if Carswell didn't pass it on at all? What if it was the wife that passed it to Holden? And we all think it's Carswell the whole time, and then it gets passed to Carswell, and then she gets what she wants. And I mean, it'd be a neat little twist.
I have the idea that it was the mother taught him kind of everything she sort of knew, but she sees him getting out of control, so it's time to take out her own son.
Yeah, see, because her interest in the paranormal and the supernatural through the medium kind of fed that. I think she was obviously interested in her own right, and I think that's how he got involved in it was because growing up around it with his mother.
She was more white magic, and she
and
saw
Carswell,
him going into that path.
We do see that he doesn't quite have as much control over this as he likes to let on. Like, he brings up that storm in the park, and he's like, oh, I got a little carried away with that.
Yeah.
Like, he actually admits it, so maybe he's not as in control as we all think he is. As well. And I mean, he's certainly fearful of Holden.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he gets out of town. Well, I mean, why would you pass that on if you think he's going to get passed back to you, that parchment?
Yeah, I mean, this guy's smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right? You're clearly afraid of that.
I think that's sort of the point. He finally figured out, oh, this guy's smart enough to.
I would love the fact that if he's leaving and realizes what's happened, that it was somebody else who did pass it on. So. Carswell's not afraid of, he's afraid of Holden and somebody else.
Because he doesn't know who that somebody else is.
Yeah, and wife or mother.
For sure.
Wife or mother.
Yeah. The person he won't suspect.
Yeah, and the nicest person through the whole movie. The person you never expect, and then you don't see that evil little bit until right at the end.
And
I love that. I just love that idea that he's afraid of something out there, and we know right at the beginning of the movie because of that newspaper that he's the head of the cult.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, so we believe he's supposed to be the bad guy.
Yeah, it sets it up beautifully, and I'm liking where you're going with it. And it could be either mother or wife. I think the person I cast as my mother would work very well in that same type of role.
Oh, yeah, but, who I have is good.
Because they establish in this movie that there were only two people who could translate the tome. Well, two people that admitted that way.
Yeah.
And that was Professor Harrington and Carswell. Well, who's the other person in the house the whole time?
Exactly.
Wife or mom, depending on how we do it. Yeah. So I really like that idea, and then making the woman the foil in this, that the villain the antagonist you never saw coming.
But see, it's sort of, it's an antagonist, but I'm looking at it like she's not so much the villain. She realizes this has gotten way out of hand, and it's time to end it all.
I like the idea of having selfish motivations,
because
that's just human nature, but she would still be that role through the whole movie because that's the misdirection. She's the kind elderly woman or the kind wife that looks like she's being subjugated by Carswell.
Yeah, no,
he also thinks he's doing that, but she's smarter than he is, and he does not know that.
Yeah,
that's
exactly she's got a healthy respect for Carswell and what he can do.
She can do worse.
He has got no idea how much she knows when he's not around.
Yeah. Yep.
And she's got her own little smaller culty circle going on with Mr. Meeks and that whole group.
It would feed really well into the help that she's giving Holden and Joanna.
Yeah.
Right? Because she's using them, like you said, to reach her own ends.
Yeah.
Right? Which is the end of...
Yeah. And that's where we got that mystery part in there. And I... if we're going to mod it, we need to make this far more creepier as well.
Ooh, so. And you can, like, you can totally keep some of the stuff where it's like, I was just showing her the book. I mean, and we can't read a word of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, she's got lots of plausible deniability through the whole thing. And it's not, it's a mystery that's not going to be force fed through to you till right at the end. You'll see it right at the end.
I don't know if this would work.
And she'll have this whole thing. She has control of the cult and this big, vast estate.
And what I'm kind of wondering, too, is I don't know if it's sort of, it may be just a reaching and just adding too many layers to it, is with the seance and like the medium, that's sort of how she gained some of her knowledge is through Mr. Meeks knowing. I don't know.
I mean, it's a possibility, yeah. But at the same time, this is something Holden has probably seen before in the trickery and fakery happening there. Although those voices are, like, mm-hmm. they're done by the actors. They're dead on, and they did a really good job lip-syncing all of that.
Yeah, it was beautifully shot, like I said. And when that kid's voice came out, I'm like, yeah.
That is creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would have done more with it because they do have – what's funny is I liked that scene, and I liked the different voices, but it didn't seem they were getting the help they needed. Because the entire time she's like, oh, this is Mr. Thomas. He comes in. He's a good friend of ours. Like, that's great. But why are these random people coming into him?
Yeah, why are these random ghosts showing up?
And the singing bit. I would get rid of the singing bit.
I'm guessing they were the local ghosts in the mansion that just like, oh, hey, our friends are back.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
to have one...
It's kind of pointless. And if it's there to lighten the mood, it doesn't really...
No.
No, I would change that so that there's all of the sort of the standard medium tropes, like the knocking and the table lifting and all that stuff, all kind of happens, and Holden's debunking it the whole time, right?
Yeah.
And then the voices start coming out, and he doesn't really know how to explain them.
I would do...
Pull a Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost. Mr. Meeks doesn't really know he can do this.
Yeah.
I would do the uncle. Well, my casting, I made him the father rather than... and made it a little more personal there, where she had a little more reason to investigate. But... yeah, I would have his voice, and then I would have the demon itself come through, or versions of the demon, or aspects, because we have, there's actually more than one demon in this movie.
And you could do like a lot of sort of weird stuff with the demon. Sound,
really inhuman sounds coming out of this human.
Inhuman world. Sounds, but you could have like, your enemy is not the enemy you think, like just some.
Oh yeah, that's where your hints are coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the demon itself is also in subjugation too, because it's at the will of the parchment, and it's guarding the estate.
Oh, you could even have it as like, your doom is in this room kind of stuff, right? So he thinks it's the parchment.
The doom is in the room. That's a t-shirt.
I love that. The doom is in the room.
Yeah, but it's something along those lines, right? It's where you could have like Holden thinking, well, it's just the parchment, right?
Yeah.
Not realizing that it's the mother or the wife, right? So all kinds of fun little clues there. Yeah, there's lots of opportunity, right?
Yeah, where the demon's actually trying to help.
Or the demon's just like, yeah, no.
Because all the bad guys are really helpful and friendly in this movie. Yeah. I would love to see it in a more backhanded way.
Yeah.
In subtle way where, you know, it's been sitting there right in front of you the whole movie.
Well, and I like the idea.
That's a great spot to do it in.
Yeah, for sure. And I like the idea of the demon resenting the people who are using this for their own ends too, right? Yeah. Like, I could totally see the demon going, well, you need,
he wants to be free.
Yeah, he wants the cycle to come to an end, right? I would love to play into that, right? Mm-hmm. Because then you're adding yet another layer. We love lots and lots of layers.
Yeah.
Can't wait to meet you. Help me stop this.
Yeah, but I like that. I think that seance scene should be more important.
Yes. It doesn't seem as really groundbreaking as it should be.
Yeah. No, because, I mean, all it establishes is that the mother's trying to help them.
Yeah.
Right?
Now, when he does get the parchments earlier during the research, we should see a degradation and escalation in the events around him. I mean, really just get some hazy vision and...
Yeah.
And the storm in the park. And then the demon that's guarding the book, but
and then
these
the
aren't escalations.
The woods, yeah.
These aren't escalations in his personal moments.
No,
and I would like to see some aspects of that as his mind is starting to unravel, because this is supposed to be psychological, and it probably was in the 50s, but it's not so impactful now.
No. See, with the hallway, I thought they were trying to do that, like, you know, that thing where they do where it sort of stretches off into infinity, and you're like, oh my god, I'm lost in this vast space.
I know how to do that.
Yeah. And I thought that's what they were doing, and I was expecting it, and then it didn't happen, and I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah, no, and I'd like to have him have more explainable paranormal experiences, right? Like all the kind of stuff that you see.
He's always explaining away what's happening to
like
him.
Weird shadows showing up in places and noises that he can't explain but doesn't believe they could possibly be paranormal.
Yeah, and these are things,
or voices, right?
Yeah, and these are things we see in paranormal shows anyway. Yeah. You know, they talk about the shadow figure, or there was a weird light. And they actually did do that in the forest with the light. I really liked the orbs.
And then the smoke.
Yeah. Like, without seeing the demon, that stuff works great. And, I mean, we could certainly do that to much better effect now. But I would have him, like, the trees kind of closing in on him. Maybe not a la Evil Dead and the rape tree, but it feels like the roots are getting in his way and wrapping around him, and it's just a case of...
Yeah, or they're tripping him, or it's getting closer.
He's going to call it swamp gas or something.
Yeah.
That he was just getting a little loopy on the swamp gas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, because Creswell told him that the forest was dangerous, and it got in his head, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, all kinds of, like, there's lots of
that's like, right, yeah. Creswell was like, you want to leave through the front door this time? I'll leave where I came, and he climbs out the window like he's Spider-Man.
Yeah. No, I always go back out the way I came in. Right?
Like, didn't he go down?
He's such a swinging dick, isn't he?
Yeah, right? He's just, like, thick-headed through the whole goddamn thing. I'm like, I'm going to go the way I came, damn it. I got to close that window anyway.
Yeah.
See, I kind of, like you're saying, I kind of like that mentality. It was too arrogant the way it was delivered, but I do like that mentality. It's like going, no offense, but I would rather go back the way I came.
Yeah, so I don't really trust you.
Right? Yeah.
You've given me no reason to not trust you, but you haven't given me a reason to trust you either.
Yeah. And I mean, he did just break into the home. the fact that he's being so nice to you, calling the cops.
Well, see, and that could be a whole thing where it's like going, look, here's the deal. I'm guessing you don't want the cops called because something might happen to me if I go through these woods. So how about we try it and see how this goes?
Yeah.
Like, he calls Criswell and the reason, like, you're being nice, but I really don't trust it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I don't know. But and then they go back to, then they go to the police for some reason at that point, which seems like an odd time to do so.
Well,
they're trying, aren't they still trying to get in to see the
Hobart?
Hobart, yes.
Yeah.
But
Hobart
that's not related to it when they're there.
I know. It did feel like a bit of a non sequitur, like it just didn't fit into the movie.
We need to establish, I think, in our remake, what happens to Hobart as well before he gets caught. And that event, that we actually need to see that event, because it just, they keep talking about it, and it feels such a disconnected part of the movie for me when we finally get, and then he's got an audience.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to hypnotize him for you, the viewers at home.
Yes.
I know.
Yeah, that was really a little off-putting, actually.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, certainly there'd be, like, witnesses to make sure that they're not manipulating this poor victim,
it looks like a theater for their entertainment.
Yeah.
Like, this is a weird presentation.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have bought it if it was more in the kind of 1950s where it's, you know, that operating theater where they're like vivisecting somebody, but use that type of setup, and then it makes it more like it's a university and they're doing something.
Yeah, that's, and maybe that's what they're trying to accomplish, but it just felt really weird.
Work.
Yeah, you know,
really weird. Yeah, like, I mean, if they were students,
that's kind of what I thought they were trying to
do. Yeah, like, let's see the effects of hypnotism on this particular type of patient. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing this, so why don't you come and watch? Right?
Yeah,
and then maybe they make that a condition of their access to Howard.
Right? Yeah,
is that, well, if you're going to be doing hypnotism, I want our interns to see what happens. Right, right. That would make sense.
Did you also catch that one of the shots was going to be methamphetamine?
What's that?
That one of the shots could be methamphetamine.
Oh, yeah, I guess it could have.
That's what he said. Like, there's two shots. One was like pentothal and methamphetamine.
That's right.
It was like
50s.
I know. Those magical energy shots, quote unquote.
Yes. It's a vitamin shot.
Yeah.
Now, when I was rethinking this, I was thinking with a younger cast in mind, I wanted to change, as I already said, Carswell, I wanted to make it his wife. I wanted, even though the plane scene's really great, this is probably going to erase it. I wanted Joanna to already know John, and she brings him in with the disappearance of her father instead of the uncle. Mm-hmm. That was my imagining of this. And I was actually going to move it to modern times, but as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, let's just push it to like the 70s.
Yeah, I didn't want it to bring it right up to modern times. I wanted it still semi-period.
Yeah, right? And especially when the 70s.
Great.
Yeah, 70s or 80s. I think 70s would be the best when things were really creepy with cults and stuff.
That's, yeah. That would work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it would make the debunking a lot more interesting, too, because you're not going to be pulling out the voice recorders and the thermal cameras and all that stuff.
The technology is still not super advanced.
But you're going to do that whole thing that they've like kind of done with The Conjuring. You're still going to have like the very basic video camera, the very basic recording stuff.
Yeah.
But it'll be because in that universe, we could still have, oh, and the Amityville Horrors happened and that was just bullshit. Like people talking about all this other bullshit that has been debunked.
Oh, yeah. Like, so, yeah, talk about.
So having that universe really it enriches it.
So much fun to talk about the house from The Conjuring 2.
Yes.
In this remake.
Well, that's true. It was also in the UK.
So. Yeah. And I kept it set in the UK.
Yeah, you could say this guy also went to this place just to make the nod without breaking copyright. Because it's a public thing, so you can still mention it.
Yes. Yeah, the Green Street, whatever.
Yeah, you could drop the name and, he was the next one to investigate after the Warrens left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
And maybe she's part of that team. She's the believer and he's the skeptic, so he's the one that's constantly trying to explain it and debunk it. You can still have that dynamic. And it would make them younger, too. And let's face it, the cults, at least in the 70s, they were trying to recruit younger people.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted drugs and sex and alcohol and
to me, and this is where you bring in the children and make it really creepy, where that's the whole Halloween party is part of the cult. They indoctrinate, they keep the children.
There's something about the whole villagers that feels old. Like it feels even older than the film. It's the 1957. Like when he goes to visit them, and I'm like, it feels like he just walked through a time tunnel and walked into the 1800s.
Yeah, it did feel that way. It felt a little out of place to me. Like, I mean, especially
maybe that's why it was taken out of the US release.
Because it just didn't feel right. Yeah.
It's also a weird thing when you're like in the UK. You do have these very old manor houses, and you are stepping back in time. It's a weird thing, and you'd have somebody who's like the lord of something. Kind of technically owns a bunch of this land, but doesn't really. Like, it's a whole thing.
The whole feudal thing, yeah. But
so
yeah,
that's why it feels disjointed, but it's because it is.
Well, and in the 50s, you probably still would have seen these family farms where you've got, like, all the grown sons are still living there, getting ready to start their families, and they're all live in the same house or all live on the same property. And that was the weirdness that I felt was, like, it just didn't feel right there, because it felt like we moved back into that feudal society in a lot of ways. I think that's what Jay was getting at, is this weird farm where there's all these men folk kicking around, no other women except for the mother.
Well, I don't know. I think it's the only way I can see to translate it is British redneck, like British hillbilly.
Okay.
Because these would be people who are existing generally in a time that is much earlier. Mm-hmm. They just haven't upgraded how they live their lives in quite a number of decades.
So this mansion is in like the British version of the Ozarks?
Sort of, yes.
Yeah, okay. But I like the idea of the whole village being sort of populated by cult members.
Yes.
Right? And they have a society and they have contact with the outside world. And I like the idea of this cult being so well integrated with regular society that a lot of people don't even really realize how pervasive it really is.
Well, he's, even though he's been outed, like, he's got a lot of money. Like, this is a big mansion house. Like, it's practically a castle, this thing. And they do make comment, like, how did he get his money? And he said he was a performer as Dr. Bobo.
But he does talk about all his followers who give him money.
Yeah.
They're Scientology.
That's the thing. We don't see that very much. We need to see that in the remake, of where the money is coming from and how much of it, how big his cult actually
is.
Well,
when you're talking about the community, you could totally make sense of this in the fact that like every business in that entire community pays money to the cult leader. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't really exist as business owners. They're like
business operators for him.
Yeah, they're like cult members where they are free labor. They don't get paid anything. They barely get any food. Like, that's what cults do.
Yeah. They got to be careful, too, because, I mean, the cops also have an interest in this guy. He's been outed publicly. the way they present him in the film, he's very friendly, very forward, and I think everything is kind of by the book, so they don't have that siege on his territory or whatever. He pays his taxes or whatever.
Yeah, I think he's really transparent, and I think that one of the reasons the cult does so well is because they are invested in their community. Is that it, like, make it really, really pervasive. I used the word already, but where they're so involved in building this wonderful community that they almost don't understand how dark what they're doing really is. Mm-hmm. Right? I think because that's part of what happens with cults is you don't realize. You get so engaged in the rhetoric that you don't realize how dark it
really is. But let's look at the darkness of it when we're talking about people really actively just giving themselves in completely to a cult. A lot of it isn't really kind of to building the community. They will put themselves in absolute destitution and their families. Like, look at Scientology. That's one of the biggest things. If you watch Going Clear, they will willingly do this. So I don't know if it's an investment in the community. It's just a belief.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I think you're more on the nose there where this is a belief. It's just, to them, it's a different God. They're not seeing it as evil.
Yeah.
And I guess that's all a matter of perspective.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And I think that's how they've sort of kept this cult under wraps for so long is because it doesn't look like a cult, right?
And I think a lot of
underneath, you're right. I think that they are so invested in it that they really don't have as much as they seem to have.
And some of this comes from the sorcery of the book.
Yeah.
Like, they are, in some ways, under control through, if it's not through suggestion and the charm of their leader, it's through fear.
Oh, yeah. If they try to leave, the demon will come for them. Mm-hmm. They will get past a parchment and there's nothing they can do.
Yeah. And that's a device, the perfect way for to sort of explain how they know about it. It's like, he's been marked. Nobody's to help him. Right. Yeah. Like that bit was really great. Right. Is because they know what the parchment is.
Pumpkinhead.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's marked.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. And it was present in this film, right? At least in the UK version that we watched, because she does say, she sees the parchment and says, he's been marked, right? Mm-hmm. There's no help for him, right?
Yeah.
So clearly they know about it.
Right? I don't know why when he finally discovers the parchment, he just sticks it in his wallet. I guess because he doesn't know what it is yet.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a bit of evidence for his investigation.
Yeah.
Because he is still investigating Carswell.
Yeah, he doesn't know what he's been passed and what it actually means.
So, yeah, to him, it's not anything other than evidence.
And that's where the investigation is. Although Carswell makes a point of telling him, like, hey, you don't have a future after the 28th.
Oh, you could have so much fun with this. Instead of having it put in his wallet, he puts it in an evidence envelope, right? And then he hands it off to a cop or like a translator. Could you translate this for me? He takes it willingly. Yeah. All of a sudden, he's the marked one. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe he can die a tragic death or whatever, right? That could add just like a whole element there. Or he says, I can't read this, hands it back to him. So he takes it back willingly.
Oh, yeah. Right? We keep seeing this back and forth before it actually does get back to Carswell.
And that could feed into the whole thing where he has the wonky visions and stuff like that. When he gives it away, he stops having them.
Yeah. Ooh, I love how this parchment, every time it's discovered, it keeps trying to get away.
Yes.
I'm not sure what that's about.
Because it wants to burn, and then it's done.
Yeah, because...
Well, yeah,
permanently marked when it's done.
It didn't burn until right at the end when the time was up.
Yeah,
but I mean, I think they were told in like previous versions it would jump out of, because her uncle said it jumped out of his hands and went into the fireplace. If it goes into the fireplace and it's destroyed, you can't pass it on to somebody else.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. You're stuck with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
when it burned on the, was it maybe that the third rail on the train?
No,
like, it's not the same parchment every time.
It's not the same parchment every time.
I think it was the one
he passed on in the movie. Like, it burned at the end, but it didn't seem to have any ignition thing.
Oh, yeah. That I think it source. Will, if it isn't passed on at the very end moment, it will burn up.
Okay, that's what I assumed. But yeah. I'm like, oh, is that a third rail? I didn't think that was a 50s thing.
We're talking about like passing around something, like it goes to evidence, passes to him, passes back. At one point, like Carswell is like, yeah, no, like he meets with his lawyer. His lawyer is like, yeah, no, there's this whole other thing that's here, and he passes it to Carswell. He doesn't know. Here's the file they have on you.
Yeah,
I love how Carswell just wasn't willing to take anything from
it.
It was so much fun to watch that. They both knew what the game was at that point.
Like that fear, like he's holding his hands on his chest, like just... I won't even touch you.
He's still very passive and friendly, but he's like, nope.
But yeah, I love the idea. It's like where Holden's like having these experiences, and then all of a sudden they stop once he hands off the parchment to the translator.
As it's getting closer in time, like it's getting really bad for him.
Yeah, right. But I can see it's like stopping briefly while a translator trying to look at it and sort of understand it, and it's sent over to analysis to analyze the parchment. So and these people start having these experiences. It's like, I have to go home. I feel really sick all of a sudden.
Yeah, right? The ruins start floating around and merging into weird visions. And
And you can have one of them who's just so freaked out, is like, look, I don't want anything to do with this thing, and gives it back to him.
I chased it around the whole room.
Yeah. But like, you could have somebody who's legit, who doesn't know what's going on, but is legitimately afraid because like, something about this makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And they give it back to him.
Yeah. And that could be one of his clues as to how the parchment actually does have.
Yeah, and Holden takes responsibility. He's like, well, I can't pass it. Once he realizes what it is, I'm like, just in case, I don't want anybody else getting hurt because of this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can have...
If this is the real deal, then I've got to make sure this gets back to who gave it to me.
Yeah, and you can have sort of a tense moment where Joanna goes to grab something that it's in, and he's like, no!
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want her to have it.
I like the idea of he thinks it happened at the museum, like, and maybe it happened during that dinner.
Ooh.
Or when he actually goes to visit Carswell to look at the thing, and it's Mom who puts it in his coat pocket or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the wife, and he thinks it's Carswell.
Yeah, and he's been looking in the wrong direction all the time.
Yeah,
right. But and I love the idea of him like because he's so good at like debunking things. I see him being really good at like things like sleight of hand.
Yeah,
his fascination with stage magic, because that would explain how he gets like the parchment into Creswell's.
Oh yeah,
jacket.
Cause we got established a little earlier. Maybe he's playing some tricks with Joanna or whatever, just doing card tricks or whatever.
Yeah,
and doing the sleight of hand and making things disappear and reappear. And
I would like to see him when Carswell used to be this old magician. Like, he's looked back on his past when he was performing. He's like, this guy's just a freaking illusionist.
Yeah,
like,
well,
that's what he hates about him.
Yeah, and that's how Holden has got into this, is just learning how the people do this. You know, gets us over. I mean, he's not going to investigate the performers as much as the charlatans.
Yes.
The people victimizing people with magic. He's fine with magic as long as it's
entertainment. And there's plenty of guys who do that kind of debunking now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if he could be like one of the first ones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we saw that character, Morgan Freeman's character in Now You See Me, right?
Yeah.
Where he was a magician, and then he becomes a debunker for his own selfish purposes.
That was a play on that magician who was revealing the tricks, the masked magician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least that was for Now You See Me.
And the odd time Penn and Teller were doing, they still sometimes do this. Like, I watched them do one debunking where it's the cubes, where they have a person in a box, and then they put the cubes in different areas of the stage, but there's holes underneath, so they'll put an arm out, put a hand out.
Yeah,
I love that bit.
It was the sliding around underneath.
Yeah, they showed the glass.
The fact that
beautiful.
You can see, Penn and Teller, and still doing that at the age that they're at now, and sliding around like they're in their 20s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love watching their show Fool Us.
They're so good.
It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we're playing on with Holden's character.
Yeah.
And that they run around debunking some of these ghostly things that are tourist traps or whatever, and it's some setup in a wall or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the 70s, so it wouldn't be like a reality TV show, thank goodness. But he's been on enough talk shows that people know who he is too.
Yeah,
he's got some sort of public presence.
Yeah. He could be that person who's like, really, he thinks the Warrens are full of shit. Like, could have that whole bit.
Well, and that
too.
was something of a criticism of the Warrens back then, and still is.
And
Warren was a door-to-door salesman when he met his wife.
Yeah.
he was all about the sale and just the jib-jab. So, I mean, there is a strong case to say that, there wasn't as much as you think it is.
Well, speaking of magicians who debunk, Houdini spent a lot of time going to
special
so-called
seances.
Mediums and seances, because he just hated people just taking advantage of people who were grieving and all this other garbage.
Because he was always honest, this is a trick.
Yeah.
It's not magic, it's a trick.
That's who, actually, maybe that's how we pattern, who we pattern Holden after.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the
Houdini type guy.
because he's not debunking your average magician doing a show. He hates it when they're victimizing people.
Yeah,
yeah. And I mean, and yeah, you could have him like doing ghost haunted houses and stuff too. But yeah, I like the idea of establishing him as being giving him a motivation for what he does.
Yeah, and he'd be the seance would be the worst thing for him to go through. Like, oh God, I haven't been to one.
That's why
I've been to hundreds of these, and not one of them's legit.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which could make this scene really powerful, especially if we go through the stuff that he knows how to debunk, like the lifting table and the knocking and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, there's a real experience, and he's not sure how to handle it. He doesn't believe it. He just can't explain it yet.
Yeah,
right. And that's.
And he gets a little even a little, because I still like the harsh aspect of it. He gets up and starts looking under tables and lifting up and checking for wires and you know, the girlfriend or just partner in Joanna would be like, just sit down, you're being rude.
Yeah.
I love how everybody just kind of puts up with his rudeness.
Yeah, and that's
that, maybe that's just the whole, he's American, we'll just. It's fine.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, there might have been a certain amount of that too, right? But I mean, that's also kind of the way Dane Andrews plays characters.
Yeah.
Sorry, every time I've seen him, it's the same kind of...
Arrogant.
Yeah.
Arrogant prick.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Dane Andrews character.
I love it.
I don't know. I liked him, though. I'd like
to see more of that.
I'd make him a little more empathetic. Charming. Yeah, empathetic, but like more charming. The fact, like, he's mad at these people because he feels they're taking advantage, which gives him more empathy, but also that he's not so grumpy all the time.
He did kind of get a little on your nerves after a while.
Yeah. Well, and the way I cast it too, like he'd be young enough to be in that still young age group that he'd be ideal for recruitment into the cult as well. Yeah. So if he could be swayed over rather than, you know, from the investigation into the cult.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be kind of what Carswell's trying to do.
Yeah.
Is trying to, that's why he's being so friendly and forward with transparency, is like, no, this is what we're doing, and maybe trying to enlist him in, for selfish reasons as well, to get him to stop the investigation.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean,
but also he's a high profile guy.
It'd be do really well for his profile.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is if Carswell doesn't get him on his side, he's a threat. This is the guy who's debunked all these famous things, right? Yeah. So it gives more weight to Holden's presence too.
I would have liked during that big storm that kicks up and Carswell claims for, that Holden would just say, well, he knew what the weather report was.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. If anybody looking at the paper would know that there was a storm coming.
Yeah.
Right?
And there should always be that plausible deniability to whatever we see.
Yeah. And let's go back to the demon at the very beginning of the movie last time. I liked your idea of having the demon sort of raise questions. I think that would be a good way to sort of set the tone of everything if you do it well. Right. I think by tying that together with the idea that all the injuries on Harrington are plausible from a car accident or a fall off a cliff or whatever demise we give him.
Yeah, right? Just like when Carswell is chasing the parchment on the train tracks, and it appears that he has, to a lot of people, that the train missed him, but when they find his body, it looks like the train ran over him and dragged him. Yeah, we see the demon pick him up, thrash him around, and then step on
him.
Yeah.
And then you see pieces flying. You actually see pieces flying, which is awesome.
Which is awesome. So, you know, it would still, for the person, people who didn't see the demon, it would look like he got ran over by a train.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it stays plausible, and you still get to have fun with the audience as well.
It's like,
is it or isn't it?
Yeah. Was there really a demon, or was this something that was happening in his head?
Yeah. What if there's some psychotropic aspect to this parchment when it's handled?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I like the idea of, because I think that's something that should be.
Well, and that goes back to something I would like to see happen with the parchment too. As it gets closer, I'd like to see that parchment starting to deteriorate a little bit, changing color, pieces
as the clock is starting to tick down. Yeah,
right. So he has, maybe instead of fire, it literally just sort of falls to dust.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So, and you sort of see signs of that, and making it harder to pass on at the end there, right? Because can you pass it on if it's starting to fall apart?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. It adds a whole new dimension to the parchment as well. It becomes its own character, which is what it was in the movie, but it just makes it that much more imperative to make sure you pass it
you
on.
Could have a comedy beat in there that I think would be funny is when he passes it on at the end, he's laminated it.
Voila. Super B is still in the evidence bag. But.
Yeah, that would be a good comic beat. I mean, it's kind of funny in and of itself anyhow, because the way it's handled, that whole scene is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you do hand it off to some scientists and things happen, they're like going, there's something weird about this, we don't know what, but there's definitely something going on with this thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that there should be some great moments in there. Like, it'd be slightly funny, but also clues.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you add just a little bit of levity without taking away from the tension.
Yeah.
Right. I think especially in the 70s, because forensic technology was sort of starting to come to the forefront, I think that would have been that'd be a really interesting bit to add.
Yeah. And I mean, when we look at supernatural thrillers now, and we see that we've had so many now, and we know what these look like with The Conjuring and whatnot, you got to be really clever. And I think this can fit in with some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If done right with the right director who knows how to do misdirection and build tension, and that's a real key to this film, is building tension and still keeping that doubt.
And that's, we're going to that, my favorite kind of horror thriller is the one where you have the, well, was it real or was it not, feeling at the end of it, right? Because those are the ones that make you, that one, you're thinking at the end of the movie. And I always love movies like that.
Yeah.
And the other is, I find that they're the ones that make me go, ugh, right, when I'm watching them.
Yeah.
It's like, is this somebody's head fuck? Or is this something that's really happening?
And that's it also ties into, like, I don't know if you have this, but like a horrifying fear of losing your mind. Like, if you get old and you get dementia, stuff just doesn't seem real to you anymore. How horrifying is that? You can't depend on anything in your head.
Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, that is one of the few things in this world that does scare me, is the loss of my faculties. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why I never liked drugs, right? Because I didn't like that loss of my faculties.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, even though I do occasionally get drunk, I don't really enjoy it that much.
No, especially the hangover.
Well, there's that, yes, right? Yeah, no, there's the happy glow, and then there's drunk. I like the happy glow.
Glow is fine.
You could have the whole thing, like if these people who are experiencing stuff with the parchment, there's a tiny hangover.
Yeah, sure. You could treat it like, you could treat it like it has been drugged. Yeah.
And the parchment, they're like going, there's no drugs specifically on the parchment, but this seems like very much the same paper they put acid tabs on.
Yeah, it does appear to have some psychotropic effects when you're touching it, right?
Yeah, we don't know what drug this is. We've never seen it before. Yeah. We don't know what's happening.
We can't find any foreign chemicals on it, but it seems to...
Well, and they wouldn't be... I mean, scientists would not be handling it with their hands. Yeah. They'd be wearing gloves and stuff. So, but there'd be something to it still.
You know, maybe because we've talked about the fact that it's kind of deteriorating as time passes, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's some particles coming off it that even if you
are we breathe, inhaling it?
Yeah, are we inhaling it? But something's happening, right? I think that would make it sort of lend that further doubt, right?
Yeah, and if it's set in the 70s, where the technology of the CSI stuff wasn't really happening yet, that all that stuff was pretty basic in forensics. So yeah.
And certainly drug testing and of paper and stuff, that would have been really challenging, right?
Yeah.
But you could still sort of do it, but it would be hard if you couldn't figure out what drug it was. Like, you sort of knew which ones were around, but you might not be able to figure it out.
Well, yeah, they weren't able to break it down into component parts and identify what chemicals are in there, right? So they'd have tests for known drugs.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like no drugs that we know.
Yeah, the careful way to construct this film is to make sure there's enough so you can see Joanna's case being built from the supernatural aspect, and enough for Holden's as well, for both sides of that argument to be held up through scrutiny.
Yeah.
Yes, you can have a lot of fun with the cult as well, where they have like a service, right? Where the whole cult is there, the whole congregation is there, and one of those supernatural occurrences happens, and it kind of leaves you with that question as well.
Yeah.
Was it supernatural, or are they drinking the blue Kool-Aid, or was it some sort of visual effect done by a form of magician?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So I just really set it up so that there's a whole bunch of stuff happening that leaves you in doubt as to what was real and what wasn't.
Yeah, yeah, like you have the whole concept too, which a lot of people probably believe, like the drug is just a door that opens up that bit of your mind where you can see stuff that's really happening.
Yeah, so if you're an audience member and if you're associating with one character or the other strongly, you'll kind of be left satisfied at the end regardless.
Yeah.
But there'll always be that little bit of doubt when you get home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Oh, you could feed into this whole partnership between the wife and the husband or the mother and the son is after that service, right? She goes and sort of unhooks the projector and turns off the smoke machine. And like she reveals, there's a reveal, right? There's an actual reveal that it was all smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
Right. And then, again, I'm making a like a whirly finger gesture around my head. Head fuck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then there's bits, too, where, like, she gives her son his tea or her husband his tea. What's in the tea?
Mm-hmm.
Might be some fun shit in the tea.
Yeah, and I mean, you could have the same type of thing happen.
And maybe that's why he's not so much afraid of Holden. I mean, by the end, I think Carswell will know he has the parchment.
Yeah.
But because those steps have been made and he realizes what's happening with his wife or mother trying to take control of the estate. And yeah, you could say maybe he's had some psychotropic effects from his tea or whatever that was served to him. And he's like, he's afraid. He knows what's going on. He needs to get the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah.
He's running for a very different reason, but it's not what Holden thinks.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
But once they're confronted, he knows what's going to happen. He knows what Holden's trying to do.
Yeah.
So you know, everything still falls back into place.
Yeah, true. Or you could have it because
it looks like he's trying to harm Holden, but the whole time he's been trying to warn Holden.
And you could have the other thing too, where because he's been drugged and he is taking off, his faculties aren't completely his. So his wife mom has already given him the parchment.
Wife mom.
I've just decided I'm just shortening it for both of our ideas. Okay. It's the wife mom. His wife mom has given it to him already. What Holden is actually passing on isn't the actual parchment.
Right. That sounds like too many layers.
I think she has to be the one who kills him.
But she does through Holden.
Yeah.
Right?
Like she's, that way she's...
she's the whole thing's about the whole situation.
The whole thing's
right?
about deniability for her.
Yeah, I don't know. Right. I like the idea of having it.
And I think she cares enough about him that she's like, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, I've gotten rid of a threat to my husband's son. right? So that works as better as a motivation for me than her handing another parchment to her husband's son and killing him outright, right? Being directly responsible. This kind of is a roundabout indirect way that gives her that one step removed so that she doesn't feel the guilt.
See, but we've already decided that they're evil enough that they want to take over the estate. What makes you think that they're going to feel guilt about killing their
husband? Oh, just because she wants it doesn't mean she's capable of doing it herself.
I think she is. I think that's what makes her a really good villain.
I think like a good cult leader, she uses her other people to do her dirty work.
Yeah, so right, and like I said, this is good. This was a win-win for her too, right? Because she either gets rid of Holden or she gets rid of her son or her husband, whatever we call him. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win for her.
She'll have plenty of opportunity to do it again with somebody else.
Not really, because we've already established that he's running away from her.
So that's true.
That's the thing. Either she sort of does it, or like, why is he running away? Because, I mean, if he's running away from her and knows that she is a threat, she's dead meat once he gets back. He'll have all his cult people kill her.
You'll have to see some subtle escalation with her as well, where you start having doubts about mom. But you got to have that realization around the same time Carswell does.
You do, but...
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe this could be something that happens because she doesn't think that Holden's going to get the parchment to...
Yeah, like I think she's going to want to ensure this happens, either to Holden or to Carswell. If both, even better. But one for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, and maybe, yes.
It could be more out of protection for her son, husband, than anything else, where she's justifying it as a good thing, and it still falls into place where he finds out what she's doing. Because he's always been above board with his cult, which is how he keeps it protected.
Yeah, but I mean, like I say, if she's not ensuring this, she's... taking a chance that's probably not good.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, that way it makes her somewhat a little more redeemable as well. Yeah, if she's doing something evil for what she thinks is a moral reason.
But if she wants the estate, then why is she trying to be redeemable?
Well, doesn't have to. We can just take that off table.
Okay.
At the end of the day, I mean, we could make that as a cut and dry murder mystery in that regard with motivation, but it doesn't have to be there. The motivation could just be trying to protect her husband's son.
But it could go into the misdirect. Follow me on this. Holden still gets the parchment to him. But, I mean, she's already drugged him. Maybe he's going insane along the tracks. But it all kind of comes together. You don't know whether he was drugged or whether
I'm not sure
he's actually
in the demon. Drugging Carswell.
Well, we were drugging him because he's running away from his wife, Mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I
like the idea that the parchment itself could be the drug. And that's what keeps it. It could be it plays to Holden's debunking thing. I don't think there needs to be something else happening elsewhere in that regard.
Yeah.
Whatever happens should be motivation towards the supernatural and something that Holden can debunk.
Yeah. I mean, I could see where Trish was going. Like, it was like have the wife mom drugging him to sort of give him the illusion that he has the parchment already somehow, but I don't see why she would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like where her motivation to make him think that he's already got the parchment is, unless it's to make him run,
mm-hmm.
right? But he already knows he can't run from this thing, right? If he's got the parchment, he can't run.
She's making him. She's dragging him to let him know that he has the parchment. I think she's just dragging him to get rid of him, and that's why he was running.
You know, no, I think it comes down to he discovers that she passed on the parchment, and because he's the target of Holden, that. He realizes where the blame's going to be coming from and what Holden maybe do, because he's always a step ahead of Holden.
Yes, he is, yeah.
And that's why he's running. It's the same way, reason why he's running in the movie at the end of it. As he's getting close to the clock, he doesn't want to be anywhere around Holden.
Because he knows that Holden's figured it out.
Yeah, at that point, he knows the steps Holden's gone through and all the pieces have been put together. Yeah. He needs to get out of there, so he can't pass on the parchment. Yeah. The results are still the same. He still needs to get out of Dodge. It's just for a different reason because, he thinks he's going to get the parchment back, even though he's not the one who passed it on in the first place.
Yes, right, because it was given. I think that's his motivation to run. Mm-hmm. You're right. And then I think there's even a bit of dialogue at that end scene there where he says, after you're gone, I'm going to go back and I'm going to deal with my wife, Mom, because she's the one who gave it to you. He tries to he tries to rightfully pass the blame on to the person who actually did it,
mm-hmm.
But Holden's past the point of believing him. So that could play really well.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and it just simplifies things a lot. And and you still have your twist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to have as many layers as we.
I know,
were
but I just I really want her to kill him.
But she does. Really do. She is taking
she does.
Her
in
steps.
The, at the end.
Yeah, in the end, she is ultimately responsible for his death.
Yeah.
Right? Because she set all the wheels in motion.
Yeah. We could see through the whole movie, it could look like she's trying to protect husband-son.
I love her.
And then at the end, she's reading the paper, cult leader, run over by train or something.
Yeah.
And she puts it down. Maybe we see the funeral or whatever, but she puts it down. This little servants have the tea and they're very sorry for what happened to your husband's son, mistress.
Yeah. And she dabs
she
at her eye.
Leaves. Yeah. She's, waves them off and the little wry smile comes up and then roll credits.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So just again, doubt. I leave lots of doubt because at the end of the day, being cut and dry motivation, having it written out in stone isn't as important as the ride.
That's right. As long as it's not confusing.
Yeah.
Right. Where everything that happens still makes sense, but still could be plausibly this or this.
Yeah.
Right. And that's
it's like Pulp Fiction. You don't really need to know what's in that suitcase.
No.
In the briefcase.
But it's been bugging people for 20 some years.
Yeah. Which is great. Yeah.
Well, that and the Band-Aid on the back of Marcellus Wallace's neck.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you want to bug people.
Yeah.
Right? Just like Jacob's Ladder. Jacob's Ladder did a great job of that.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's get into some casting here because we've got some crazy stuff going on already in our remake. So let's see how this goes. And we know Trish cast it in a different way than I did. So
very different.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I will start with actually just a minor character, which is going to tell you how I made it cast the rest of
okay.
it. Kumar, who's the other kind of East Indian guy, I made it Cal Penn. He's going to be a little more involved in all this stuff.
Yeah, he's so minor, we didn't even talk about
him. Yeah. So John Holden is John Cho, because I like him. I can see him being a debunker. Joanne Carrington is Natalie Emmanuel. She's Fast and the Furious. She was the hacker that doesn't do any hacking for some reason.
Yep.
Dr. Carswell, Jack Houston. So I did go younger as well with that. Professor Harrington, I went a different way because I really like this actress, Natalia Tena. She was in Game of Thrones. She was with Bran and them for a little while before she got killed.
Yes.
So I made her kind of a sister rather than an aunt or so. And then Mom Carswell, Julie Walters, because Harry Potter. And then Mark O'Brien, Dev Patel, Mr. Meeks, Tom Felton, another Harry Potter. And then Hobart, I just put an A Hobart. I don't know how that scene would really play out, but I put Tom Hopper in as Hobart.
I didn't cast Hobart, but I'll go with Tom Hopper.
Okay. I'll do mine, and then we'll go on to Sam's, because I had a different direction. Like I said, I kept my cast young. I made Mrs. Carswell the wife rather than the mother, and I made Professor Harrington Joanna's father rather, just to make that connection a little more personal. And
I went sister, so it's they're still family.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all had the same ideas in that regard. Now, for my Dr. Carswell, he's the real main focus of this thing, and you want somebody charismatic for a 70s cult leader, and I went with Tom Hiddleston.
Nice.
Because I'm still keeping it.
He came across my list, too.
Yeah. Nice. I just saw an interview with him recently. I'm like, yeah. I think, he had a little bit of facial hair, and I'm like, yeah, he's got that handsome cult leader. He can certainly, he has the suave and charm. Yeah. So I think that would work well. I went with Jenna Coleman. It was Joanna Harrington.
Jenna Coleman.
She was the Doctor's companion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Doctor Who. I'm not sold on my John Holden, but I kept him early 30s. I went with Emile Hirsch.
Oh, ooh, nice.
I could buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is great because he's already worked with my director, Andre Overdahl. It's hard to say because he's Norwegian. Sophia Miles, I went with Mrs. Carswell as the wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was also in a bunch of British stuff. She was in one of the Doctor Who episodes. I think it was the Blink episode.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went with Sean Pertwee as the father.
Nice.
Professor Harrington. And that was the only ones I cast. So did you have a director? I don't remember.
Oh, I didn't. But in talking, when we're talking about like theories, and we were discussing when I got jump scares, James Wan.
There you go. James Wan. And mine was the director.
He'd make it look really pretty. I think.
My Norwegian director was the guy who directed Troll Hunter. So
just
to put it in a context for people.
See, and I thought, did he do Autopsy and Jane Doe, or who did that?
Yes,
one?
He did.
Okay. That's when you're talking about Emile Hirsch. I was like, that's what I thought.
That's where they work together.
Awesome.
All right, Sam.
Okay. So I went a completely different direction than either of you. So I kept an older cast because when I saw the first few minutes of this, with Holden, I had my John Holden. I want George Clooney as Holden.
I thought about it when I was still thinking, when I was deciding which way I wanted to go, because when I thought Bond villain, I'm like, it'd be really cool to move it in that direction. Yeah. And then you could get away with an older cast. Yeah. And I'm like, I want to do George Clooney, but I've kind of decided on my direction. Yeah. So I was kind of stuck with it. And it made me really struggle with my casting. Yeah,
Clooney sort of scream that character?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. And you have the world weariness where he's been debunking for a while.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I wanted to go with him. For my Joanna Harrington, I'm going to have to change the last names because I went with Selena Jade, who's Chinese, from Arrow. For Dr. Harrington, even though he's got a small role, I went with Daniel Dae Kim because I like him.
Oh, nice. He's good.
Yes. And
now that he's not on Hawaii 5-0, he's available.
Yeah. Yes. Even though he's Korean and she's Chinese, I know I'm not making the assumption that all Asians look alike. But
well, it's not like he's Hawaiian either.
That's true.
Yeah. You could have it through marriage.
Yeah, exactly. So for my Dr. Carswell, I went with Timothy Spall. I went with somebody who's got a very similar body type to our previous one. And I love Timothy Spall. He's good in every single thing he's done. So I went, why not?
You can see him being sort of that magnetic leader.
You can see him being charismatic. I've seen him in roles where he's not playing sort of the smarmy guy like he was in Harry Potter, or the lackey like he was in Rockstar.
Mm-hmm. Right?
For my Mrs. Carswell, I went with Charlotte Rampling because...
Oh, she's good.
Yeah, nice. And I mean, she can play sneaky, evil, badass.
Yeah.
really, really well. And that's I went with her, is because I wanted her, you had to question her, even when I was casting, I wanted her questioned, right?
Nice.
Nice.
For my Professor Kumar, I did do Professor Kumar. I went with Shahrukh Khan, who is an actor, he's a Bollywood actor.
Oh, okay.
Cool. He's a quite famous Bollywood actor, actually. He's done some North American films as well. He did a movie called My Name is Khan. If you haven't seen it, please see it. Really good.
Khan!
Yeah. Oh, is that a comedy one?
No, it has moments of comedy. Yeah, it's a comedy drama. It's a tragic comedy.
Okay, I'm getting confused with a different one then.
Yeah, but yeah, I would recommend it if you haven't seen it. After 31 Days of Horror, though. For my Mr. Meek, because I wanted to cast the psychic as well, I went with Ewan Bremner, who played Spud in Trainspotting.
Ah, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I think he'd have a lot of fun kind of bringing that humor to that role, but still bringing the creepy factor too, because we've seen him do it in Trainspotting, actually.
Yeah.
And then for my director, I went with Alexander Aja.
Yes. Oh, also, yes. Very good. That's what I thought you were trying to say.
Yeah.
Yes. Great choice.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, mirrors, horns. Yeah.
Exactly. I was just thinking about mirrors. No, like the mood of that is beautiful.
Yeah, he's got a good resume of horror movies and psychological ones.
Yeah, and that, and when I remember that he'd done mirrors, which is like so much in the head that I'm like, yeah, this is what I want.
Yeah, and I want to. Yeah, this. Yeah. He kept the spirit of like J horror. So in that one,
yeah, he did.
And I think we all kind of in our ideas of how we're kind of visualizing that is like the beautiful, because it's going to be like in the British countryside and these manor houses, like these beautiful gothic imagery.
Yeah,
that these directors know how to do.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
So interestingly, yeah, we all sort of had different ideas in casting, but we definitely
our
wanted
approaches
the same,
were similar.
Yeah, we wanted the same feel.
Yeah,
right? I mean, this one fleshed. I hadn't fleshed out exactly how I would want it to go, but
I had a loose idea, but it usually comes together while we're talking.
Yeah. Oh yeah, like I had a bit of an idea, but the thought of putting it in the '70s made it make more sense.
Yeah,
I was struggling with that
right up until we started recording. I was going to have it modern day, and I'm like, no, I think it'll work better in the '70s.
Because when you're talking about cults, you're absolutely right. That makes so much more sense. That they were kind of a height then.
Yeah. And just there's a attention to that concept.
And our drug angle as well. It also comes up.
Yeah, everything kind of works if you set it in that era.
Yeah, it's definitely when it was all sort of really prevalent. And this also started the prevalence of these paranormal ghost hunter investigators too, mm-hmm. right? When you really think about it, the 70s was right when the Warrens were really active, right? Mm-hmm. Amityville and all that stuff was all happening.
Yeah, and there was quite a bit of a boom in that as well because of them. Yeah.
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 So, yeah, it just ties really nicely together.
Yeah. You had Leonard Nimoy and In Search Of. Yeah. And like a lot of programming was kicking up in the early 80s and late 70s around the supernatural. And it's all happening again. You could probably update it if you wanted to. But I like the idea of keeping it in the 70s where the cults were really at their heights at the time.
True. And like you have this sort of meta moment where the guy's like, no, this isn't like it is in movies.
Yeah.
Like this isn't not just like some supernatural stuff you put in a movie. No.
But yeah, no, I like the idea of really developing our lead character as a paranormal investigator, debunker. Because they kind of allude to it. I mean, he's being interviewed as he comes into...
Yeah, and Joanna is some sort of relationship with him, either a friend or they dated at one point, and she calls him in because of what's going on to have that more debunking side of things, you know, from what appears to be supernatural, maybe not, and he can open doors that maybe other people won't be able to find, and that's why he's brought in.
And for sure, she knows she's her...
It's personal for her.
Yeah, he was already investigating and now he's dead. And she's like, no, she kind of wants justice at the same time.
Yeah.
And she knows that Holden can help her get that.
Yeah. And it just looks like an accident and she's not believing in that. So that's why he's being brought in is in that kind of PI role.
Yeah. I mean, he's already on his way as a favor to her
yeah,
uncle
and
dad.
And maybe he's doing some filming regionally or investigating some famous haunt or whatever within the UK. So he's already kind of there. It's a shame to lose that opening scene, but on the plane, I'm sure they can find another spot to inject some humor into it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Or they can find another place to put a big desk with wood paneling around it.
Right.
Where it doesn't make sense to have a big desk with wood paneling. That's the important thing it has.
We could have that as a callback.
We could have it. Maybe that's the, where, I don't know, maybe he's doing some investigation, big desk, you know, he's meeting with whoever runs this haunt or whatever, and then there's this weird row of seating that looks like it's on a plane.
Yeah.
So we just reverse the role.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they're sitting there going like, wow, the last time I saw it, like, you've really moved up in the world. Your last office was like the galley on a plane.
Oh, yeah. You can just, yeah. You can just say something. Yeah, put it in the dialogue where it's a good throwback.
Yeah. That would be so much fun. Good.
And I just thought, we talked about like also throwbacks to war investigations and stuff like that. That could be why he's in England. He's like, yeah, I'm here to investigate that house, but those other guys were already there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's a nice callback to another franchise.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, that
they,
that.
Yeah, that they.
The haunting was done, so it's public record.
Yeah, it's public record. Okay, well, I mean, this was a great grab from 1957. Lots we could work with. I want to know if there's any other forgotten great classic horror movies from the 50s or the 60s that you want to see on the show. We do take requests. We do take challenges. And you can let us know on our social media. We're at Invasion Remake on Twitter. We are invasiontheremake@gmail.com if you want to email us. And of course, we have our Facebook page. You can message us there as well. Please like the page. And of course, you can help us spread the word about the show. If you dig the show, please spread it out on your social media and tell your friends. You can do that by leaving a four or five star rating on Apple mm-hmm. Podcasts and iTunes and leaving a short review. And you can do that on, of course, the other sources you like to listen to the show on as well. And you can tell people how to find the show. Maybe you have an iPhone and your friend has an Android. Just tell them what apps we're on. And we are on mm-hmm. a ton of apps. Just tell them to search out the one you're most prevalent with as yeah. far as your podcast apps and podcast providers. But we are on, of course, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Blueberry, Spreaker, and frickin' YouTube.
Frickin' YouTube.
Frickin' YouTube. So, and of course, lots more places. If you don't use any of those, we're probably on it as on whatever you listen to as well. Even I don't know what we're all on because it aggregates out in so many places. It's awesome. We are literally everywhere. Yes. The invasion has begun. Yeah,
but not in a culty way, just because this show made me think of that. We're not a cult. We're just...
You just think we're not.
Oh, crap.
That's right.
Damn it. I started a cult and didn't realize it again.
Did you look at that note I gave you?
Ah, shit. Well, gosh, it's been lovely for this last episode I'm going to be alive for.
No, you get the dates on there, too.
Oh, okay, so I get to be end of 31 Days of Horror.
Yeah, you get
at least that long.
You get at least that long.
Oh, that's good to know. That'll be my 31 Days of Horror, just my slow deterioration until my death.
Well, technically, Sam gave you that note. I think I gave it to him, but he's like, no, nobody's replacing me with Jeff.
Jeff 3.0?
Hey, Jeff 3.0. Yeah, I guess it's going to have to be Jeff 3.0. I don't know who I want to pass this on to. I'm not mean like that.
Well, that was it for Night of the Demon. You'll have to join us next week to see if Trish has survived and passed on that note or not.
We'll see. I don't know. There's some assholes out here. I could do it.
7 days. Yeah, it's too bad you can't get face-to-face with a Cheeto, eh?
Oh, if only I could. I'd make him eat it.
Oh, there's some.
I like the Cheetos cat. Oh, we're not talking about that guy.
No.
Oh. I was like, how are you going to pass it on to a cartoon cat? But we're not talking about
I
that,
would never do that to a cartoon cat.
No. Yeah.
Although there are some local politicians that could use a parchment.
For sure.
Mm, yeah.
We're in local elections here in Calgary, everybody, and it's going to be insane.
Yeah. We'll find out tomorrow. It'll be over by the time you hear it. So.
Yeah.
We'll see. Elections in general just seem to be going to shit every time there is one. So we'll see.
Every once in a while, I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. Democracy all is right. Kind of stupid.
We're not going to talk. No politics.
The fall of Babylon. Stop it.
They're going into places I won't talk about. So that's it. I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I think I'll be Trish for at least a little while yet.
Okay. We'll see you next week. We are out of here.
Do I believe in witchcraft? What kind of witchcraft? The legendary witch that rides on the imaginary broom, the hex that tortures the thoughts of the victim, the pin stuck in the image that wastes away the mind and the body.
Also imaginary.
But where does imagination end and reality begin? What is this twilight? This half-world of the mind that you profess to know so much about? How can we differentiate between the powers of darkness and the powers of the mind?
Isn't that
terrifying?